You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
All right, period. Okay, that sounds like we're on now. Okay, again, good morning. I'm Doug Elliott from the Economic Studies Program here at Brookings, and thank you again. This morning, our panelists will examine the structure of the market for equity trading here in the U.S. and discuss ways to improve it. This may seem a bit of an arcane subject, but one can see its importance by considering that the market capitalization of listed U.S. stocks is in the neighborhood of $20 trillion. So we believe that the technical nature of the policy issues has resulted in too little focus on how to optimize the performance of these important markets, and that led us to design today's event. So we'll hear from two panels. The first will provide analytical background on the equity markets and will highlight views from the regulatory and academic spheres. The panel will be moderated by my colleague Martin Bailey, who you'll see in a moment. He's the director of the Initiative on Business and Public Policy here at Brookings, and he was formerly the chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. The second panel brings representatives from different parts of the industry to discuss their views on the structure of the equity trading markets and what ought to be done going forward. And I will be moderating that panel. So without further ado, let me turn the mic over to Martin Bailey to introduce the first panel. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and we thank everyone who's braved the 10-degree temperatures and the delays on the red line to make it here. I think we're hopefully going to have something that's worth everyone's while. Following the financial crisis, the emphasis was largely on what went wrong and who was responsible and how could the regulation be changed to make the system safer. I think that was an understandable focus. But fortunately now, I think we're seeing more research and more interest looking at what it is that the financial sector does, what roles does it play, and more importantly, how do market structure and regulation either facilitate or potentially impede that process. And we're fortunate today to have a distinguished panel of people, or two panels, who've been answering those questions all along, even before the crisis. And in particular, looking at the market trading side of this. Our first speaker will be Doug Elliott, who is, you've already seen, Doug had a lot of experience as a practitioner in financial markets, primarily at J.P. Morgan. He's now a very prolific and distinguished author here at Brookings and researcher looking at financial regulation and at the financial system. He's also done a lot of work with the folks in Europe, understanding their approach to regulation and some of the agreements and disagreements between us and Europe. And he's going to set the scene for our discussion today. Following Doug, Greg Berman, who is the Associate Director of the Office of Analytics and Research in the Division of Trading and Markets at the SEC. He covers equity market structure, clearinghouse risk, derivatives transparency, broker-dealer capital, and other things that that you have on his resume. Prior to the SEC, he headed the risk business of Risk Metrics Group, and prior to that, he co-managed some hedge funds. He has a PhD in physics from Princeton. Now, he'll be followed by Daniel Weaver, who has a PhD in finance from Rutgers, where he is also professor of finance and associate director of the Whitcomb Center for Research on Financial Services. His teaching and research focus on security design and security market structure, and recent papers include an examination of the value of liquidity providers. Dan is widely quoted in the media and has testified to the SEC and to Congress. He'll be followed by Chester Spatt, who received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania and is professor of finance at the Tupper School at Carnegie Mellon. He was previously chief economist at the SEC and director of its Office of Economic Analysis. And his research has focused on market structure, trading pricing, and valuation. He's a member of so many things, I can't list them all, but of the Model Validation Council of the Fed and of the Systemic Risk Council. Okay, so I'm going to step down and not bounce back up and down. So let's start with Doug, and then each person will go in turn. Thank you.
So, hello again. I thought I would just take a few minutes to, as Martin said, give a little background here. One of the things I think you're going to find for those of you who are non-specialists, and I'd include myself in that, because I cover financial regulation very broadly, but not this area so particularly, is these discussions can get very technical very fast. But what I think we need to keep in mind is what are the central objectives that the various parties have and that we think should be the objectives of public policy, and what are the trade-offs between these. Trade-offs are particularly important partly because the system seems to actually work quite well. So we're not talking about a broken equity trading system where we might be looking at radical reforms. We're talking much more about how to take a basically well-functioning system and work out the things that are problems and find ways to improve. That tends to push towards solutions where there are trade-offs, and we just have to decide what's most important. So if we go way back, I do think it's useful to briefly think about why we even have equity and why we have markets in equity. In primitive forms of capitalism, it was difficult to get the money together and allocated, particularly for large projects. And so we ended up having the advent of managerial capitalism, where we had professional management, and of joint stock companies that could bring in money from more than just a family or a clan. By doing those things, we have better management standards, larger, more far-flung enterprises, much better opportunities for investors. It's not just who you happen to know in your family that might be able to do something with the money, and therefore improved allocation of capital in the whole economy. Well, once stock ownership becomes important, then it also becomes important to find ways to trade the stock, because investors value liquidity very highly. They want readily saleable instruments. And when you create exchanges, you create access to capital at much cheaper prices. It also allows investors to diversify. And as a byproduct of all this, trading of stocks allows important market signals to show us whether companies are doing smart things with the money or not so smart things, and therefore push managements in the right direction. So it's good to have this working well. Now, different key groups here have somewhat different but overlapping objectives. I mean, everybody wants the system to essentially work, but they have different priorities here. So you need to think about investors, the businesses that issue stock and therefore raise money through this, the larger public, and then, of course, they're the operators of the trading venues and related services. So going through them one by one. With investors, I think it's easy enough to imagine what their objectives are. They want to be able to execute at very low cost. They want to do it quickly. They want to do it with certainty. They want fair access to the market so there's not somebody else getting a better deal and therefore pulling down their relative return. They want transparency about what everybody else has done or is willing to do, like with bid offers. At the same time, especially if they're a large investor, they don't want everyone else to have that same transparency about them, at least while they're in the midst of executing a large trade that can take some time. And then you've got specialized investors such as arbitrageurs that may have specific objectives that I'll leave aside. Businesses mostly just want efficient, effective trading mechanisms so that investors are willing to buy shares without tacking on a big premium of some kind. Therefore, the businesses can raise money at reasonable prices. They also want deep markets, so if they want to sell additional shares, they can do that relatively easily without moving the price too much. And, of course, they want a minimization of any kind of technical problem that might cause big stock price movements for purely technical reasons. The public, of course, wants the investors to be happy and wants the businesses to be happy, because what we most want is for this to be an effective way for businesses to raise money and for investors to deploy capital. But we also, as a society, have additional things we care about. we have fairness standards. For instance, there actually is some argument that insider trading makes for a more efficient market by getting information subtly out there, but we don't think that's a fair way to run markets. And there are other points where we feel, regardless of market efficiency, we simply don't want to do things in a way that seems unfair. And further, of course, while none of the individual actors care very much themselves, as a society, we want stock prices to reflect fairly the long-term prospects of the companies. So we don't want technical factors from how the markets work to get in the way of that transmission of information. And then, of course, there are the service providers. And you'll hear from a number of them today on the second panel, so I won't go into great length. The simple point is, this is a big enough market. There are a fair number of people who make good money by helping make these markets work. You have the stock exchanges. You have the operators of dark pools and other trading venues that aren't stock exchanges. You have liquidity providers of various kinds, information providers, and I'm sure I've missed some categories here. Well, all of these are important to the functioning of the markets, and they all share an interest in the markets fundamentally working, but they also have contrary interests in many cases as to how the pot of profits from all this gets divided up. So my final slide is just to say there are many trade-offs that you're going to have to consider as you hear the first panel and the second panel. Some of these involve transparency versus confidentiality, such as when a large investor wants to do a trade that will take time, is it more important for us as the public to have the information about their initial trades out there, or is it more important to give them some time to execute so that it's possible to have large investors? Similarly, we want free competition among trading venues because competition tends to result in better outcomes, but this can also create systemic complexity by having so many different parties doing things different ways. Another thing is trade-offs between methods that assure that people get the best price versus methods that assure very, very fast execution. And then fairness can play against many of these other objectives. So let me leave it at that, and I'll turn it over to the people who are actually more expert in this area. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here today and be able to talk about some of the subtleties as well as some of the bigger picture aspects of market structure. We didn't have a prep call or rehearse anything, but a lot of my comments I think are going to echo very much what Doug had said. So I'd like to take the theme a little further in a certain direction. So I have a hypothesis. The first portion of the hypothesis you just heard, but I'd like to reemphasize that because it is a hypothesis that actually might be in the minority right now. The markets are not broken. In spite of what you read everywhere, in spite of what many market participants say, and in spite of what many jurisdictions and other regulators might say about the equity markets, they're not broken. And I'm convinced of that for two reasons. One is I have a very good sense of what broken is and what broken is not. 3 weeks ago, Stephen Huff, international pianist, did a great concerto at Kennedy Center. Some of you might have caught that. My wife and I got dressed up, put my suit on, went to the garage, went to the Volkswagen, turned the key. Nothing happened. It didn't ding. It didn't do anything. It just sat there staring at me, and I kept turning the key, and nothing happened. Do you know why the car didn't start? It was broken. That's what broken means. On any typical day, there are somewhere on the order of 5 to 6 billion shares that are traded. If we be conservative and say the average trade size is 200 shares, which it's not. It's actually lower than that, but it's easy to do the math that way. That's about 30 million trades. 30 million trades conducted on a given day from tens of thousands of individual asset managers representing tens and tens of thousands of funds, hundreds of thousands of retail investors, and all the liquidity providers. And on any given day, you might get a note from a marketplace that says, we are breaking the following 9 trades that occurred in the following 6 seconds because of a problem. Very, very few industries have that low of a level of failure. But when you do have a very low level of failure, those failures make the headlines all the time. So I think I have a good sense, and you do too, probably of what it really means to be broken, and the equity markets do not fit the criteria of what's broken. So that's my first part of the hypothesis. The second part is that there is something that's broken. There's something I think that's very broken and in the need of repair. The debate on market structure is very broken. I think the way that we talk about market structure, I think the rhetoric that's in the industry right now is needs to be fixed. So, well, I think it's easy to show the first. Why do I say such a statement like that? Well, if you look at where the debate on market structure has taken us over the past year or so, there seems to be focuses in a very myopic portion of the market, and people tend to be using evidence that may not actually be good evidence of certain practices by ignoring some of the facts. Now, that's a very abstract thing to say, so let me put some concreteness around that. Last week, there was an article, maybe at the beginning of this week, I think, in the Wall Street Journal, which yet again echoed that the problem with the market is it's too complex. Now, that's a fair comment. One should explore complexity and see whether or not complexity actually is causing any material issues or any significant issues. So there's nothing wrong with making that statement, but you do need to then line that up with some of the facts and see what the issues are. So what's the number one thing that people pin on complexity of the markets? The number one thing that people talk about, and this has been going on for 2 years now, is complexity in the markets is the cause of all the failures and the market disruptions that we have. They're the cause of the mini flash crashes. They're the cause of the problems with NASDAQ on their Facebook IPO. They're the problems with Knight. They were the problems with when the CBOE goes out. All of those are caused by the complexity of the market. That's easy to say, but I think we really should test that and see if that's true. And when you look at what actually happened in any of those instances, it does not at all seem like complexity is the culprit. It seems like the issues are much, in certain senses, a little bit more difficult. They are problems with core technologies. When it comes to a lot of the little blips that we see that people say are market breakdowns, those are caused primarily by fat finger trades, by people who say, I thought I was going to buy 800 shares. I'm sorry I put in 85,000 shares, and the stock only trades 8,000 shares a day. My fault. I guess I'll have to eat that. And that's, you know, that's it. That doesn't seem to have anything to do with the fact that we have diverse or fragmented market, depending on how you look at it. It has to do with people who are just not doing basic fundamental checks and balances of their trading. So that continues to be out there in the ether. That complexity has created those issues. That really doesn't seem to hold true. The other aspect that we hear a lot about is that because of the fragmented nature of liquidity and the markets themselves, this has led to a lot of the complexity of high-frequency trading, of the speed of the markets, of the rapid cancels that happen and the orders that are placed, et cetera. Again, a good hypothesis. So one can test that. One can say, is modern market making through high-frequency trading and speed, is that a result of complexity? Is that a result of fragmented markets? Is it a result of things like the maker-taker model? Fortunately, there is another market out there. There's another market out there that doesn't have any of those characteristics. It's even larger in certain respects than the equity market, called the futures market. And what we found in the study of the flash crash and what the CFTC found in subsequent papers is that high-frequency trading can dominate the E-mini market, which is an equity index, just as much as it can dominate and influence the market in equities. So if that's the case, that there's lots of high-frequency traders in the futures market, well, that's one market. In fact, it's completely vertical. Clearing, trading, all happens in one shot. Where's the fragmentation? So there must be something more to the debate about market structure than just the nature of fragmented markets and the nature of complexity, because it does not lead us to the right conclusions. So I'm going to, just a few minutes I have left, give you some thoughts on what I think those things are that would more help or better help the debate on market structure. I think there are three ingredients of market structure, only one of which is currently being really debated and in the ether. There is a very significant focus, it has been for quite a number of years, on the concept of orders and cancels. How fast the orders are going in and how fast they're canceled. The orders are canceled. There's legislation around the world about slowing down the market because they have labeled the market as being speeded up by the fact that there's orders and cancels. Lots of questions about algorithmic trading. Unfortunately, for the debate, what's missing from that are two other aspects of the market. The first is those who post orders are not the only ones who use computers. They're not the only ones who use algorithms, and they're not the only ones who have a vested interest in how those orders get placed. The entire buy side, whether it be retail investors through their broker-dealers, large asset managers who are running money for institutions, or large asset managers who are managing a 401k, they all use execution algos. They all are trying to facilitate the exact same thing, but on the opposite side. They take liquidity instead of provide liquidity. But the dynamics are still there. And in a paper that we just published in October, we were able to show that the characteristics of off-exchange trading look exactly the same as the characteristics of on-exchange trading. So it seems like the use of algos to facilitate buying and selling stocks by buy-side institutions is the same as whether or not they're doing it on-exchange or off-exchange. So if you only look at those who provide liquidity without looking at all the systems and the methodologies that take liquidity, you're really only looking at half the equation. And the third and final point I'll make is the last of the missing ingredients that people very rarely talk about is not just the marketplaces and not just the participants, but what about the things that we actually trade? What's their influence on market structure itself? So we started with a world where we primarily had equities trading, and now on any given exchange we have a wide array of products, exchange-traded funds, exchange-traded notes, other types of exchange-traded products. You can trade commodities, fixed income, emerging market debt, all through intraday trading on an equity exchange. There are huge implications for that. That drives a lot of the market structure that's out there. And I think a lot of the work that we've done at the SEC in publishing data on that materially shows how there's different order and trade cancellation ratios for exchange-traded products than there are for equities. That doesn't say anything negative, or it's not meant to say anything negative, about the products themselves or about how buy-side institutions use algos. My big point is that in order to really understand how the markets work, if you don't look at the interaction between the buy-side and the sell-side institutions, and you don't look at the interaction between the products that are being put on the markets and how people trade them, then we're only looking at a very, very small part of the market. At the SEC, myself and my colleagues are trying to inform this debate. We, many of you may be familiar with the new website that we put out. We're trying to put data out there that directly shows how some of these interactions happen. We'll be doing that throughout the upcoming years. We've gotten a lot of good feedback on that so far and look forward to continuing providing that information as we try to tilt the debate more towards something that can be actionable as opposed to something that uses some of the bigger words of complexity and other types of abstract concepts. Thank you.
Are you going to talk for me? Perfectly fine.
Might be a short presentation then.
No shorter than mine. You know, I'm reminded – thank you. I'm reminded of a comment that you made earlier about the transparency, people wanting to know what's going on in the markets. For many years, I've had discussions with traders, and they all tell me, I want to see everything that's going on. I want to see everybody's order. And I used to tell them, okay, well, that's fine. If you get to see their order, they get to see yours. Oh, no, I don't want to show mine, but I want to see theirs. And I heard this so much. It was so – antithesis to logic, I finally got up here in Washington, a regional STA meeting, and said, look, you have to admit, you all want to go to the nudist colony fully clothed. And you can see all light bulbs going off in the audience. Oh, yeah, now I get it. Okay. Now, I agree the markets aren't broken, but perhaps they might need a little tune-up, as they always do from time to time. And so we're going to talk about that today. Okay. I thought I would start by talking about where we came from, how we got to where we are. A lot of people aren't aware of that. They start off with today, and they don't understand the history of where we came from. In the good old days, we had manual trading. Orders were delivered by phone, and quotes were conditional. That meant that published quotes were not expected to be valid at all. We also had very wide spreads induced by 1/8 ticks that carry over from the 1700s. The crash in 1987 and what happened after it brought about a significant change in the markets in my view. NASDAQ repurposed the small order execution system so that for the first time, NASDAQ bids and offers could be lifted or hit it or lifted from the system. It was the first wide usage of automated execution. So related to that, Harvey Halkin, the fifth Jersey boy, learned how to use the system to his own benefit and to the demise of some market makers by hitting stale quotes. He was the first Sow's bandit. He was actually the forebearer of today's high-frequency traders. So they trace their roots back to the late 1980s. NASDAQ at the time viewed itself as a pure dealer market. Public limit orders were ignored. They had Manning 1 and Manning 2 as proof of that. The BBO was defined as only NASDAQ dealer quotes. The only electronic communication network out there was Instinet. And almost all order flow was subject to preferencing agreements between brokers and dealers. This thing moves. Either a cash payment for flow or in-kind soft dollar payments. The New York Stock Exchange, liquidity had inertia. Regional stock exchanges and dealers paid for order flow, but they weren't able to siphon much off. Orders went to where liquidity was. But these payments they were making were substantial. They were substantial for two reasons. Number one, the minimum spreads that market makers and specialists needed to stay in business were much smaller than the spreads that were induced by having a discrete pricing grid due to large ticks. And also, if you could partition your order flow into orders that were small and retail orders, which were uninformed, then you could avoid the adverse selection component of spread, and you would end up with an even smaller needed spread compared to other people who did not partition their order flow. In 1996, we had the order handling rules, another big step forward. Limit orders are now able to directly compete with dealer quotes. This led to the creation of a large number of alternative trading systems. They featured automatic execution. They charged traders to access quotes, a taker model. They didn't pay rebates at the time. They didn't have to. NASDAQ had done everything. NASDAQ dealers, I should say NASDAQ, the association didn't. NASDAQ dealers did everything they could to discourage public limit orders. And because of that, when they were able to compete with dealer quotes, the public sent their limit orders to these ATSs to compete with NASDAQ dealers, not to the NASDAQ dealers themselves. That was beginning of all of these maker-taker models. Larger tick size, as I said earlier, led to spreads being wider than they should have been. This led to excess profits, which could be used to pay for order flow. Critics felt, including a number of people in Congress, that payment for order flow led brokers to route orders to venues that paid them the most. Okay. And so what we did is we reduced tick sizes from an eighth to a 16th and then a penny. The tick sizes reduced payment for order flow, but it did not eliminate it. Why? Because people could still reduce their needed spread even further by limiting the orders they paid for to small retail orders, these uninformed orders. Today, the ATSs have adopted a maker-taker model. They started just a taker model, and then to compete with the exchanges and to try to steal order flow away from the exchanges, they established legitimacy by having all limit orders from NASDAQ. They then focused on NYSE listings, and they were able to adopt a maker-taker model to take a lot of order flow away from the New York Stock Exchange and the other exchanges, and the exchanges to compete, went ahead and adopted their own maker-taker models. In addition, brokers have learned how to earn the spread rather than routing orders. They either internalize where they earn the entire spread themselves, but that gives them risk of price movements in that inventory. They can eliminate that risk, and they've done this quite well by establishing dark pools and charging people with the right to be able to internalize effectively the orders by interacting with the orders on these dark pools. Does it matter? Yes. Battaglio, Corbin, and Jennings have a recent paper that shows that brokers tend to route orders to the venue that pays them the most, gives them the biggest rebate. And they find that this results in lower market quality in that their definition of lower market quality, orders that go there to these high rebate venues tend to stay there longer. And so if you're missing the market, then you're experiencing a reduction in market quality. I have a paper on internalization that shows that higher internalization rates lead to wider spreads. What could help? Trade at rule. The Toronto Stock Exchange adopted a trade-out rule, and when they are similar to a trade-out rule. And what happened is they experienced a significant reduction in spreads following that. Now, critics say that it's not necessary, since spreads are lower than they've ever been. But the correct metric is not to say spreads are lower than they've ever been. Correct metric is how low could they be? Could they be even lower? And I think they could be. Also, critics say we should allow venues to compete for order flow. I hear this all the time from my colleagues. We should allow venues to compete for order flow. The problem is they're not competing for natural buyers and sellers order flow. They are competing for your broker's order flow. And those rebates don't necessarily flow back to the individual investors. Imagine if you hired someone to choose the correct cell phone company for you. We don't want that. We want to choose it ourselves. But we allow this kind of intermediated model in securities markets. I want to touch on another area that has come under recent scrutiny. We've had a dearth of IPOs, especially small IPOs, in the United States in recent years. And people are trying to come up with a way to correct this. And one proposal has been to adopt wider ticks for IPOs. The idea being that wider ticks will attract more liquidity. Why? Well, we know that wider ticks leads to higher payment for order flow. In this case, higher rebates. Higher rebates will encourage people to submit limit orders. That will in turn turn around and give you more liquidity. However, wider tick sizes lead to wider spreads. Wider spreads are directly related to the cost of capital. Wider spreads will lead to a higher cost of capital for these small startup firms, which will limit their ability to expand. And another issue which hasn't been addressed is that trading of IPOs these days is very fragmented, and that hasn't been addressed as perhaps a cause for the problems we have in lower number of IPOs. I have a paper looking at consolidated versus fragmented IPOs, and we conclude that consolidated IPOs have consolidated information. As a result, they have much lower underpricing. Now, the way we look at it from the company's perspective, they leave less money on the table. And so that's another issue that may be a problem out there. We used to have very, very consolidated IPOs. Now we have very fragmented IPOs. I have an alternative proposal I'd like to put forward. Instead of widening ticks for IPOs, I think there's some merit there, but I've thought about it some more, and I think the problem of higher cost of capital induced by wider spreads is going to be a big problem there. Have IPOs trade exclusively on a single exchange for a significant period of time? Okay, that's going to get rid of the fragmentation, give you consolidation. Now, how do we take care of the liquidity? Rather than having wider tick sizes, which lead to wider spreads, what we should have is a liquidity provider, someone who's paid, a specialist-like person, a market maker-like type person who is paid to create liquidity in that stock. They're paid by the company. This is against the law in the United States. It shouldn't be. It's stupid for it to be against the law. It works without a problem in many countries in Europe, and we should do it here. And we should leave tick sizes alone. Smaller tick sizes will result in lower spreads. That will result in lower cost of capital for these startup companies, and that will help them to expand more and help the economy. I think this is a superior proposal to the one being put forth now. With that, I think I've suggested how to tune up. I'm not sure whether or not it'll work. Thank you.
So it's a great pleasure for me to be here. I should say at the onset that some of the things I'm going to say you've already heard from the prior three panelists. My apologies for that, but I think this sort of reflects the nature of the issues that are currently getting attention. So first, I want to sort of step back a little bit. And sort of ask some broad questions. Whom should we care about? And this sort of relates to some of Doug's remarks. What sort of an important in the broad? So for the first observation I want to make is that one of the things that's striking to me about these issues is that we have all this discussion about equity markets, and not only on this panel today, but in the broader debate. There's a lot of public interest, a lot of public attention. And we're talking about tiny, tiny differences, and yet incredibly little discussion about our bond markets. Little discussion, and yet in some of the bond markets, particularly the municipal bond markets, spreads are extremely wide. To the extent that regulators view their responsibility as focused upon protecting retail investors, it seems to me that there's a lot of scope at a first order level for more attention to the bond markets, to transparency and other kinds of issues. And while there's been significant headway in that space, it seems to me that a first order margin I want to point to is the difference between bond markets and equity markets with respect to market structure. I certainly agree that the welfare of issuers and investors is key. I also want to emphasize that it's not, you know, that the folks who really weigh in heavily in this debate are the platforms, the NYSE, the NASDAQ, and other platforms. But ultimately, the decisions, the public policy decisions, seems to me, shouldn't really pivot upon whether a particular mechanism sort of fits one firm or another firm's business model. I think the trading issues here are important to the broader society. Now, the platforms are most vocal because of the link to their business models. But interestingly, sort of putting that aside, it's surprising to me how politicized some of the debates about equity market structure have been, especially given their technical nature. The issues have been evolving, but it's also striking to me that these issues have been out there literally for decades. In a recent speech, for example, SEC Commissioner Mike Pewar pointed to the 1962 market design study undertaken by the SEC. And so you can see these issues have been out there literally for decades with a focus on equity markets. I also think that it's important to emphasize the focus on ex-ante design issues. One of the things that's been striking is a lot of the turbulence associated with market design seems to be focused on glitches, whether it's what happened, the flash crash, or the problems that Knight had, or various the problems of BATS, various problems. And it seems to me the market structure issues are, and our attention should be much more from an ex-ante perspective. So at a broad level, just kind of continuing at a broad level, and then I want to talk about a couple of specific issues, I think it's important not to evaluate issues in isolation. A lot of times people kind of cut into these debates and express a view about a particular aspect of market structure. Seems to me that understanding the equilibrium responses of market participants is extremely important. And cutting in and tweaking or thinking about tweaking one aspect of market structure without considering the other aspects is a real mistake conceptually. I also think that we clearly had in the period of time when I was at the SEC as chief economist in the middle part of the prior decade, we had some really big changes in market structure in the name of regulation NMS. Now, it seems to me that one of the first order things one would think one would want to do before considering further changes is to try to understand what can we actually learn from what happened. And obviously, NMS had big impacts on the nature of competition within and across platforms, on the whole issue of fragmentation versus centralization. It just seems to me that trying to learn from, you know, as they say in other contexts, we want to try to learn from history so we don't repeat the mistakes of history. One issue in the issue in market structure which has probably the most traction in the regulatory community right now is the issue of tick size, in part because of its relationship in calls for study in the Jobs Act. So the SEC appears to be moving forward to do a pilot study. I think doing a pilot study is probably sensible, but I'm skeptical that this is at the root of the inadequate access to capital. So in the remainder of my comments, I want to take up a couple of specific issues, and obviously this will overlap a little bit with what others have commented on, the maker-taker pricing model. I want to say a few things about that, and that'll certainly tie to the earlier comments. I'll make a few comments about high-frequency trading, and finally I'll talk a bit about rapid cancellations and whether these are problematic, sort of the issue in related to the issue of flickering quotes. The maker-taker model basically allows the supplier of liquidity to get rebates and the demander to pay, but it's actually not quite that. It's not quite that the supplier gets the rebate, but his broker gets the rebate, and similarly for the demander. Well, as Dan pointed out then, it's not, you know, there's some interesting empirical evidence that points out that the cost to the broker in terms of these rebates play a huge role, and it seems to me that's reflective of a important conflict of interest. Now, clearly, you know, traders should, even absent conflict of interest, should adjust their strategy to execute on the opposite side to receive rebates, but it does seem to me that this maker-taker model, does raise a lot of issues. It basically transforms what appears to be the nominal tick size into something finer than that. That is, in effect, the tick size is not consistently being followed, since the net prices are potentially inside the trading grid. Rebates are not available to all market participants, and they're often received by the customer rather than the customer. This creates an inherent conflict of interest in routing. And by the way, I should also note that the effect of rebates and fees have grown in relative terms at least, have grown considerably since NMS, enlarging the conflict of interest. Another way to say that is to the extent that basic spreads are down, but these maker-taker levels are similar, the proportional impacts of these are actually much bigger than the past. I just want to make a couple of observations about high-frequency trading. I view high-frequency trading at least as having the potential to enhance liquidity and speed of execution. Now, I know there's debate about this, and I think there's important legitimate issues. Clearly, investments in speed are costly, co-location, and, you know, whether it's speed or co-location or various kinds of technologies. But it seems to me that it's certainly legitimate for those investments to then be compensated for with a return on investment. Now, it clearly raises some issues of selection, because not everybody is going to have a comparative advantage in doing this. And it's certainly possible that these investments in speed could be wasteful or dissipative. But I don't think it's enough to sort of just simply assert that, and to say, a millisecond, we don't need to have pricing in a millisecond. It seems to me economic analysis has to go beyond that. One has to really sort out, I think with careful thinking and methodology, whether these investments in speed are wasteful. I don't think it's sort of simply an assertion because of some seemingly common sense intuition, that a fraction of a sec, a sec, a second is kind of good enough. Is good enough. I think some of the remedies that also people, I think there are sort of better remedies and worse remedies in this space. So one remedy that I think would not be very good is a minimum resting time. Basically, by minimum resting time, refers to a situation where a trader puts in an order and then he can't cancel it, let's say for a second or for some other fixed amount of time. The problem that I see with that is that then the order is then frozen and basically is ripe to be picked off by everybody else. And I think that's going to potentially severely undercut liquidity in the markets. And I think that I really see that as problematic. I think far preferable to that would be to introduce perhaps some noise in the timing process, which I think would be a way to at least diminish the import of timing. And then finally, I wanted to just briefly comment on some issues involving cancellations and flickering quotes. There's this intuition out there that there's a lot of very rapid cancellations. I think this is basically a very confused intuition. Then people point to flickering quotes. Well, in a rapid trading environment, the quotes are going to flicker. Absolutely. Even when I studied limit order data 20 years ago, we saw that the spreads were moving in and out. I guess except that the time wasn't so rapid. That's a flickering quote. That's inherent in liquidity provision. Liquidity provision, the bid and ask prices are not going to simply move in parallel. Often you're going to have an intervention of liquidity, you're going to have supply of liquidity on one side or the other side, and the spread is going to be moving around. And you can call that flickering quotes or any other kind of term you want, but just inherently the fact that these things are happening rapidly doesn't necessarily mean that it's a problem. And in fact, to kind of make that point, I'm going to pose a question. Why are orders often canceled quickly? And it seems to me the intuition for this is quite clear. That basically people put in orders and then cancel them quickly. They may have bad motives too, but I want to suggest a reason that doesn't involve bad motives at all. It's simply an attempt to limit exposure when the order doesn't fill. So you put in an order, you're hoping to fill. Now, there may be people who put in orders with no interest in filling. There may be people who put in orders whose fill rates are essentially zero. Okay? I mean, and so I'm not ruling that out. But I also want to suggest that even people who have good intentions, they may not have super high fill rates. They may have fill rates 10, 20%, 5%. Now, why is that? Because you put in an order, you're trying to fill, but you're also trying to be cagey about it because you want to get good execution. You only want to fill conditional upon getting a favorable execution. And so you put in an order, and the order doesn't fill, maybe because conditions changed or because conditions didn't move in your favor. So when you put the order in. So what do? Well, now you're concerned that you got this order out there and you're now exposed to somebody picking you off. You're exposed, in effect, to adverse selection. So what do? You cancel the order. Very simple. In the old days on the New York Stock Exchange, they had a simple term for this, and that's fill or kill. That was a type of order that was an old order type on the New York Stock Exchange. And what was the purpose of this? That was so the customer could send down his order to the exchange and he could fill it if he could. And if not, it wasn't going to hang around. And that was just embedded in the order type. Now, I don't know if that was explicitly counted as a cancel or not, but it's exactly the same economic function. Now, one of the things I found actually very interesting that I learned from interaction with the SEC, with respect to their Midas system is that in fact it seems that the order placements, that the MITRE system suggests that the order placements occur almost as quickly as the order cancellations. And I think this is sort of very consistent with the type of intuition that I'm describing. In equilibrium, it's reasonable to expect a close connection between the speed of cancellations and executions, and indeed that's what the data suggests we have. It is true that the speed of cancellations is somewhat greater, but not dramatically so. And so I want to suggest that the issue of flickering quotes and that the extent to which people are canceling is maybe not as much of a problem as many suggest. And frankly, the fact that the cancellation, thinking about it from the point of view of the relative speed of placements and cancellations is a potentially a constructive way to think further about the issue. All right, let me stop at this point then.
So try to remember to press your button that says speak when you speak and press mute when you've stopped speaking. Thank you. We've had a very interesting, I think, set of presentations. And I won't attempt to summarize, but let me give one reaction, which was that it's said that the markets aren't broken. So basically they're working very well. There may be some few tweaks that need to be made to these markets. But at the same time, I also heard quite a few of those tweaks discussed. So I wonder if I could go to you, Greg, and just ask you to respond to some of the comments that were made here about some of the issues that may not be working perfectly, and whether the SEC is addressing these, or whether you think these are not as important as were laid out. Maybe I can be more specific, or can you give a general reaction to the other speakers that you heard?
Sure. So begin by saying, it goes without saying that obviously these are my own comments and don't reflect anything necessarily reflect anything on anybody ever. So that's a nice general statement to make. If you look at where the big ticket items are, I often lament that we started with the equity concept release in 2010, and we laid out quite big questions. What is the nature and the impact of high-frequency trading? What is the nature and the impact of off-exchange trading? And we asked a lot of questions. It's a great document. It's available on the website if you haven't pulled that down. And then we had the flash crash. And that really overtook a lot of the questions about, well, what do we think about off-exchange trading when we have stocks going from $40 to a penny and then back to $40? So a lot of the emphasis and a lot of where we try to target things like investor confidence and market stability came out of what happened with the flash crash. And then as we started implementing all of that, and all of that seemed to work fine, then we had some of these more technical problems with the markets. Some are quite small, and most people don't recognize them. Others were very, very large. So we start focusing on those aspects of the markets themselves, the technical stability. We have a proposal called Reg SCI, stands for Systems Compliance and Integrity, out for public notice and comment. So we start down that path, and then we have a hurricane. And I recently put into a speech that I was writing, while we don't know what the impact of high-frequency trading is necessarily, we're fairly certain that high-frequency traders did not create Hurricane Sandy. And people struck that. They said that, you know, can you demonstrate that for sure? I said, I can't footnote that. You know, I'm sorry, I can't do that. But that led to a whole other path of market integrity and market stability. Along these lines, along this whole way, though, has been questions about tick size, has been questions about maker-taker. So all of those we're continually looking at. I think what you'll find is on every one of those topics, at 10 o'clock in the morning, we will meet with a whole bunch of participants who have a very, very strong opinion saying you must do X. If you do Y, it's the end of civilization as you know it. And then at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, after those participants leave and others come in, they say, if you do X, you will destroy the world as we know it, and you absolutely positively must do Y. So a big portion of what we're trying to do is really get ahead of that by saying, can we look at something objectively? And I think a number of panelists mentioned this already, is we're not here to pick business models and say this, you win, you lose. That's not our role, and it's a very dangerous role to be in. So what we have to look at is basically what some of the panelists showed on the slides is what works for investor protection, what works for fairness, what works for efficiency in the markets, even if that actually messes up with one business model and biases another business model. But we have to take that type of objective stance as we're looking at the markets.
Thank you. Let me raise, be a little argumentative here, but raise something that was in the Wall Street Journal article and ask Chester and the other panel members to respond. And in that article is an example that T. Rowe Price ran an experiment. They directed one of their brokers to buy 2.5 million shares of a heavily traded stock. And then they sought step-by-step account of how the broker made the purchase. And they said, to hide the purchase from fast-moving traders, the broker placed and canceled many small orders all across the stock market, creating, quote, a dense smokescreen of phantom interest in the security. And in total, the broker offered to buy 750 million shares of the stock while actually purchasing just 2.5 million. Okay, so this is perceived by at least the folks at T. Rowe Price as creating a smokescreen of making it difficult. But I think you were saying that cancellations are not a bad thing and that some of these things are not that important. So any reactions to that sort of criticism, if you like, of the way the thing works now?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think my views about that example are actually somewhat equivocal, and I'll sort of explain why. I'll explain why in a moment. My views about the types of examples that I had in mind are completely unequivocal, and in particular, you know, what I was pointing out is that seeing lots of cancellations and high cancellation rates don't strike me as problematic. On the other hand, you know, I've read in the last year or so about enforcement actions that had been brought against people who basically had no interest in basically doing any trading, and were just basically heavily using the cancellations to create a lot of smoke. And it seemed to me that those enforcement actions, as an outsider, seemed to me to be warranted. Now, in this particular case, I don't know that I know maybe enough about the nuances of the facts. I do think that a trader, you know, my own view is that a trader potentially putting on orders on both sides so that his intentions are less than clear should be a permissible practice. Now, whether I'm sympathetic to scaling it up by a factor of 300 and whether they're doing actual executions by a factor of 300, that's less clear to me. But the basic notion that, you know, if I've got a big order, that I ought to be allowed to do something a little bit more intricate than just splitting it up into equal size pieces or exponentially declining pieces, and be out there as a sitting duck for the rest of the world to figure out pretty quickly what my ultimate size is, and then to kind of completely move the market against me instantaneously. It seems to me this ought to be a permissible practice, absolutely, as investors try to minimize their price impact, and it would be a mistake to prevent that. But you know, clearly there's sort of, you know, when you're hearing of folks doing that on a scale of 300-fold, you know, obviously that raises real and legitimate questions.
Any of the other panel members want to comment so far, Doug?
You know, I tell my students, change the rules and traders will change their behaviors. Some of the regulators, not necessarily the ones on the panel, but regulators in general seem to forget. This whole issue of putting orders in there and cancel came up when the Toronto Stock Exchange on their CAT system switched from price time priority to price pro rata sharing, which means you got a portion of every incoming order if you were on the book, depending upon how big your order was. And so we did a study of that, and what happened after they switched from price time to price pro rata sharing, the size of orders went up. They inflated their orders because they wanted to get the whole order filled, and they couldn't do it just by going to the end of the queue. Now they made bigger orders, and then when they got what they wanted, they canceled the rest of the order. So order size went up and cancellations went up. You change the rules, you're going to change the behavior. It's exactly what T. Rowe Price found.
Yeah, let me just make a very general statement. First, something that struck me about all the other speakers is they correctly showed how little we actually know about how many things in the market work, that we have a very general idea, but we don't necessarily have the facts on it. There's an inherent trade-off between giving some protection to large orders to allow us to have large-size asset managers and institutions, which is a desirable thing, and the potential problem that they don't want to get picked off, and therefore they're going to do a bunch of things that disguise the intentions. This is an inherent issue. It's existed for decades, if not centuries. Deciding what the right trade-off is probably requires us to understand much more empirically than we do what those trade-offs specifically are. And then we can decide if – it strikes me, if the smokescreens are as big as was described in that article, then probably we've gone too far in that direction and whatever makes that happen. But I don't know exactly how to judge it.
If I could make just one point, because I think that the quote from T. Rowe Price in the discussion in the article is actually very, very germane. But I think, Doug, as you mentioned, a lot of these are nuanced and subtle issues, so not everybody may know the distinction between the types of cancellations. So over the past few years, the focus on cancellations has been from liquidity providers. It's been from the concern that high-frequency trading firms are putting in orders and they're canceling it, that they're not really providing liquidity. And we've heard a lot about different opinions on that. The article and what T. Rowe Price had mentioned is not that. It's not that at all. It's exactly what I was saying during my opening remarks, that it's what the buy-side institution is doing through their broker-dealer to basically say, well, we can do that same game as well, or we can play that as well. So if we're just looking at cancellations in the context of those who provide liquidity, there's the other side of that, which is the algorithm that they used to try to place a very, very large order. Now, I don't know if the exact facts, and I don't know if it's really 300 to 1 or what that is, but clearly when a large institution wants to place a large order, they want to prevent the rest of the world. They want to go to the nudist colony with their clothes on. So they want to have the best of both worlds. Now, there are many studies that are out there, many studies, that try to measure the concept of price discovery. That's the purpose of the markets, to bring buyers and sellers together for price discovery. What is price discovery? Price discovery is when everybody stares at each other and tries to figure out what the real price of something should be based on the needs of the people who want to buy and the people who want to sell. And we have many people who come into the SEC and pound the table and say, I'm very concerned about price discovery. Price discovery is not working. By the way, I would like to buy 500,000 shares, and I do not want to move the market. So there is a conflict of interest between those who want price discovery for everybody else but do not want price discovery for themselves and for their own orders. And what a critical aspect of this that unfortunately I don't think we know is, what is the real price of buying 500,000 shares of a large cap stock or 50 shares of a small cap stock? Everything we do is measure relative. Maybe the price of buying 500,000 shares of Microsoft should move Microsoft 5%. Maybe that's what a theoretical model would show. And anybody who gets less than 5% movement, you should consider yourself quite lucky. But we don't know that. So we're everybody basically, it's a blinking game. You stare and you try to hide what you're trading.
I thought about various things we could be discussing today. I didn't think nudist colonies was going to be one of the main features. You had a quick comment you're going to make, and I want to just ask a question a little bit about IPOs also, and I want to throw this over to the audience. So can I ask for just quick responses on this, and then can you press your button?
Yeah, so one quick follow-up. So I think what a number of the comments highlight is that that traders are, you know, and most directly to follow up on Dan's point, traders are responding to the mechanism as they perceive it, and, you know, I would just reiterate that traders have a legitimate interest in trying to protect their customers, and so, you know, and so I think as we interpret examples like this, we should certainly keep that in mind. But that's not to defend 300 to 1, but on the other hand, to take the other extreme, to require traders to simply trade in the direction of their net position, so that they're gonna lose lots of value to the leeches in the system. That seems to me a ridiculous standard.
Did you have a comment? So let me ask about IPOs, and please, in the audience, just think about some questions. I'm going to throw it open to the audience. IPOs are somewhat dear to my heart. We have a recovery that's been slow. One of the missing links in that recovery has been the number of new startup firms. What are the motivations for companies they start up is that they may want to go to an IPO. Doug said, and I want to quibble with him, that the equity markets are a major source of capital. Well, yes and no. The number of new issues actually tends to be less than the number of share buybacks. So in net, I don't think we get a lot of new capital from the equity markets. But the ability to trade and the ability to do IPOs, I think, is particularly important. Do we think that the current market structure or the current level of regulation, as has been alleged by some people, is inhibiting the number of IPOs? And if so, what can we do about it?
Well, I guess I have to be good at pushing buttons up here to be able to speak. I'm not so sure it's inhibiting. I think that we've gotten to a point where it's difficult for IPOs to get liquidity, and people don't want to get involved in an IPO unless they know they can get rid of the stock. And so the market has changed, and we haven't changed the rules for IPOs. I think that the tick size, increasing the tick size for IPOs is in the right direction, but I think it might be, after I've thought about it some more, I think it's a bit misguided.
Greg, is there anything you think that SEC is thinking about? I know there may be limits to what you can talk about, but is this an issue that you're concerned about?
IPOs in general, as part of the capital formation process, capital formation is one of the central tenets of the SEC. So yes, we think about this all the time, both for capital formation through the equity markets, and I think as others have mentioned, to the non-equity markets, to the fixed income markets as well. The idea behind the tick size did come from the Jobs Act. And we've had roundtables on that, and there is quite a lot of activity going on, both in the industry and at the SEC. I think a number of commissioners, our chair, has expressed the desire for a pilot to see what would happen. I think there are different interpretations of what a change in the tick size might mean. So the original hypothesis that goes back to the Jobs Act was, if you raise tick sizes, there will be more liquidity. There's more liquidity. There's larger prices that market makers can get larger profits. Those profits, in turn, translate to more research, which in turn turns into more interest, and the cycle continues. I think at our roundtable, and quite a number of people have said, I understand and can conceive of the first part, but not so sure about the second part. But you don't have to necessarily either before or believe the second part to at least test out the first part. So a lot of the market's been now concentrating on, if you change tick sizes, there might be more liquidity that becomes posted at a wider tick size. We've been doing a lot of preparatory work to try to measure what the effect might be. And part of this is, if you're going to do a pilot, it would be really good to know what you're measuring before you start the pilot and not wait until the end of the pilot so everybody looks at each other and says, by the way, so did it work or did it not work? So we're doing a lot of the prep work, and a lot of the prep work is actually showing something that I bet you very, very few people in this audience know, which is that most of the liquidity is posted today away from the NBBO, not at the NBBO, which calls – puts a big question on, would you rather have a market structure of 500 shares posted at one penny away and 4,500 shares posted 2 cents away, or all 5,000 shares are posted 2 cents away because 2 cents is the minimum and you can't post at 1 cent? And what our data is showing, you'll see more coming out of the SEC on this in the upcoming months, is that there's a lot of liquidity that's already posted away from the inside. So I'm excited about the potential of a tick pilot, maybe for different reasons, which is I think it's going to illustrate something about the market that is much broader than even maybe just what's going on with IPOs.
So I'm going to throw it open to the audience and get a look for some questions. We do have microphones. There's one on the side there and one at the back. So please wait for a mic. I'd like you to identify who you are, and please pose a question, a relatively short question. So let me ask the audience to ask some questions. Yes, the question here.
Frank Hathaway, NASDAQ. Just to start where we began with Greg, and I'll talk about cars rather than nudity. So these notions of the market being broken and the market being complex. My first car was built in 1968. I could open the trunk with a key. That was the only way I could open it. My current car is much newer. I can have a remote switch inside. I have an automatic on the remote. I can open it with a key. The automatic function of my trunk does not work. I can only open my trunk with a key. So the first question, is my car broken? All right. Then on the notion of complexity, that first car didn't have a lot of parts. It had no GPS. It didn't talk to me. It didn't move the seats up and down. As the market gets more parts, if there is a standard probability of a failure, of a fat finger, doesn't the fact that my new car has a lot more than my old 68 one essentially mean it's more likely to have something broken, whether we consider the whole thing broken or not?
Okay. Who wants to take that one on? Greg, it had your name on it, but others can certainly speak up.
Greg had the bad car today.
So I think you bring up an excellent point. So I think that, yes, when you have more complexity, there are more aspects of things that can break. So I think the question is correct. But I'd like to then hold up those things and see, so what is broken when we have these failures? And I guess I would argue that you can open up the trunk with your key or with these 100 other methods. But what if you actually found that the problem was with the key? It was the key mechanism. The same mechanism that existed 50 years ago, that was the thing that kept breaking. And I think what we sometimes find is that really that's the thing that's breaking. It's actually not these other fancier things that are the things that are causing complexity. But it's not the complex things that are breaking. It's the simpler things. The other point I would make is the complexity has to be put into the context of what does it give you. So people want GPS in their car. If you had a car that had no GPS, that did not have an automated lock, that you couldn't open it up by wiping your foot underneath the trunk so it pops up, which I'm going to buy because it just looks really neat. But you had all of this electronics and you still needed to use a key, then that would be needless complexity. So a lot of the complexity that's in the market, one question is how much of it is needless? It's just noise. It's complexity for complexity's sake versus how much of it is that's what people want. I mean, I've done this many times, but damn, this is complicated. This phone can store all of the quotes from every market on a given day. It can't store 2 days. It runs out of memory. But I can do everything, include make toast because it gets very hot and you put bread on it. So the complexity is driven by what people want sometimes, and we have to consider what the nature of the complexity is.
Okay, another question? There's a question here, and then I'll come to you.
Jim Allen with CFA Institute. Chester, in particular, you were talking about some of the issues and the conflicts of interest with the maker-taker models. Your predecessor, I think, at the SEC, Larry Harris, has suggested that, in fact, the SEC should maybe do away with maker-taker model, and that would, A, sort of take care of the conflicts of interest, but wouldn't deal with the competition, price competition amongst the exchanges. What do you think about that proposal?
So I'd be relatively sympathetic to that. I think eliminating maker taker may be about the simplest way to get to deal with this conflict of interest. Now, you know, I think some conflicts of interest seem to me to be secondary, but in the case of the routing decision, I think the problem is that the routing decision seems to be driven. I think the paper that Dan mentioned really provides strong evidence of this. The routing decision seems overwhelmingly to be driven by the maker taker model and the potential for conflict of interest. So So I think it really does raise a lot of questions. And I think it raises questions, too, about the nature of our tick size and whether the tick size is what we're saying it is or it's something else. So I'd be relatively sympathetic to moving in that direction.
How about you? Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure.
Assembling the table.
Yes, I am.
That's okay.
I'm not so sure if I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, it's a payment for order flow is around forever. Is the way to get there. I think that if we get rid of make or take a model, we also have to get rid of internalization. As long as I can partition order flow into informed and uninformed, then I can make extra money. So. Maybe one way to do it on maker-taker models is to require them to take all orders, no matter what their the dark pools, for example, are accepting orders that are only small retail orders. And I think it would be better served if they took all orders like a specialist or a market maker would.
We had a question there.
Hi. My name is Rob Tricanelli. I'm with Bloomberg BNA's Securities Regulation and Law Report. I wanted to ask on tick sizes, there's a bill in Congress, came out of committee unanimously, full House might take it up soon. That would it's a five-year pilot program to increase the tick sizes where small emerging growth companies can choose to be traded at a 5 or 10 cent tick size. Curious if you've been following the bill, if you have any comment on the merits of what it would do.
Well, I haven't been following the bill that closely. I think my own view is I would much rather have the professional staff at the SEC design the pilot than have congressmen design the pilot. And indeed, in one dimension that you referred to, the issue of allowing the companies to choose, I could well imagine that a pilot that would be designed by the staff might involve some greater degree of random assignment. And if certainly that were the case, what we would learn from the pilot would likely be significantly greater than one that had a massive amount of selection bias.
I want to address that. I want to go back to something Greg had said as well. When you increase tick size, you're going to increase spreads. When you increase spreads, you increase the cost of capital. That's counterproductive. I'm not so sure that will work. As far as IPOs are concerned, small companies in particular, we keep adopting the attitude of one size fits all, and that's absolutely false. You know, Greg talked about a company that has 500 at the inside, and 4,000 2 cents away. That's great. Chester, Frank, you remember back when we reduced tick size, all the discussions about, well, all you're doing is taking all the liquidity at the wider tick and distributing it down, and we really need to sum, there were some papers that summed them all together. That works for large, well-capitalized stocks. But small companies, we're not talking about 500 at the inside and 4,500 away. We're talking about 50 at the inside, 50 away, and nothing at the inside. These small companies have no liquidity. It's not a question of it's there, we just have to find it. They have no liquidity, and the best way to find that liquidity is to adopt exactly what they've done in Europe, which to have a liquidity provider who is paid by the company, the people who are going to benefit the most from this, to provide liquidity. The company, for example, in Stockholm, they get to negotiate with liquidity providers to decide on what spread would you like and what depth you would like. I think that is a preferable model to increase in tick size, and I think that we ought to do away with the stupid law that says that you can't pay a market maker or specialist in the company.
Do you have a thought on that, Greg?
Yes, just two follow-ups on that. The example I gave with the liquidity at the inside, I think this is going to surprise a lot of people that actually holds for small companies as well. It's just people don't look. Now, it's not – when I say 500, maybe it's not 500 at a penny, but it's 50 shares out at 15 cents, but 300 shares – out at 18 cents. But if you only look at the 15 cent and not at the 18 cent, then you're missing something. So I think what we're seeing is that the dynamics, for, especially for small cap stocks, are much more complicated than just looking at the inside, and especially if the inside is actually at 15 or 20 cents, because then the idea of doing a 5-cent tick actually has a different dynamic than doing on a 1-cent tick. So the point is that it's actually complicated, and that's why sometimes pilots are interesting, because they help pull these types of things out. On your follow-up comment about the issuer pay, I guess I would say that a lot of rules in the equity markets actually aren't SEC rules. They are SRO rules. They're rules by the exchanges themselves. And over the last year, all of the listing exchanges have put forth exactly what you have suggested. And they've been approved. They've been approved on a pilot basis to see what will happen. And the SROs put that forth for exchange-traded products, not for for individual companies. Though in many of the orders that they had put forth in the rules, they had said, let's look at this. This works good in Europe for IPOs and for companies, but they are choosing to do this in ETFs right now. So there's a difference between saying that one should prevent something from being banned and one should actually force something to happen. So if SROs came and proposed that, then that would go out for comment. So it's not necessarily that this is not allowed.
Yeah. Martin, could I?
Yes, up? I was going to give you a...
Thank you. No, I'm just curious, Daniel, and maybe others have information on this. What you're describing sounds useful and interesting to me, but clearly that's also an increase in the cost of capital. Basically, that if a company is going to have stock out there, then there's this continuing cost it's going to bear. Have you done or seen studies that have compared the potential increase in cost of capital from that to the increased cost of capital from the present system?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
When we studied what happened in Stockholm, essentially companies, listed companies, can decide this like they would net present value. They look at the pluses and minuses. And what we found is that even companies have very wide spread. Companies choose this because they narrow their spreads. Spreads went down by more than half when they choose this model. But not everyone chose to, because it's a negotiated contract, and some of the liquidity providers are charging so much because of the problems with the company that it just would cost more than it would to than the benefits they would receive. And so a company's going to do an analysis. Exactly what you're saying. Am I going to get more than it's going to cost me? If I will, I'll go ahead with it. If not, I'm not going to. So it won't help everybody, but it will help a significant number of small companies.
We have run out of time. I want to thank the panel for terrific presentations and discussion, and thank the audience for their questions. We have a second panel, so stick around. Don't go anywhere. We're coming up with the next panel.
Okay. Yeah, if you could. Okay. Okay, good morning again. We'd like to start with the second panel now, so please, those of you who aren't taking an emergency break, please sit back down. And as is probably obvious, I'm moderating the second panel. This is going to bring representatives of different segments of the industry to give their views. We will lead off with Brian Conroy, president of Fidelity Capital Markets, the institutional trading arm of Fidelity Investments. His full bio and those of the other panelists is available outside if you do not already have it, so I won't go into his distinguished career. Brian will be followed by Ari Burstein, the Senior Counsel for Capital Markets Issues for the Investment Company Institute. Thomas Whitman will follow. He's a Senior Vice President at NASDAQ OMX and Head of U.S. Equities and Derivatives for the group. And finally, we will hear from Jamil Nazirali, Senior Managing Director and Head of Citadel Execution Services. We'll follow the format of the first panel. Each of the panelists will make their prepared remarks. I will then moderate a discussion with them and followed by a chance for the audience to ask questions. So with that, let me turn it over to the first panelist, Brian Conroy.
Thank you. It certainly is an honor to be here today speaking to all of you and amongst this quite distinguished group of fellow panelists. I, too, woke up this morning and didn't expect to have several conversations around automobile issues or nudist colonies or some of the other things that we've discussed already. Certainly, Doug's opening comment, which he mentioned, things can get technical real fast. I think we witnessed that today. But as a former religion major and football coach, I'll try to keep it pretty high level, which is usually where I live for the benefit of all of us. I'm going to throw out a few terms because I think these terms are really defining the discussion in the marketplace today, for better or worse. HFTs, dark pools, flash orders, too big to fail, speed of trading, market fragmentation, tick sizes, algo trading, payment for order flow, etc. What these words are doing, what these phrases are doing, are skewing in many ways the debate around what is the marketplace today? How is it relative to the rest of the world and relative to where it has been? Well, I think when you look at the rest of the world as a percentage of GDP, there's twice the notional value traded in the U.S. than the rest of the world on average. So I think that speaks to, as one of the panelists said earlier, liquidity is one of the cornerstones of the marketplace. So clearly in the U.S., versus the rest of the world, there's quite a bit of liquidity. Also, when you look at various market impact statistics, we are also either at par with or certainly far ahead of other venues. So when you look at the U.S. versus the rest of the world, I think it's a reasonable conclusion to draw that we, in fact, are the envy of the world with respect to developing nations, broad-based markets, and equities. And then we look at what's happened to the equity market over the last 10, 20 years. Certainly, it's very hard for anyone to argue that we're not in a better place. And I think as Doug mentioned in his opening statements, better doesn't mean best, and certainly there's always room for improvement no matter how far the gains have come over the last 10 years. But when we look at average daily volume, again, it's more than a double over the last 10 years. So we hit a peak, about 4 years ago, and we've come off that peak. But, certainly, $4 billion in 2003 and $9.5 billion on average is greater than 100% increase. Certainly the speed of execution has come down, for better or worse. We talked about – the first panel talked about the pros and cons of speed. But, for a retail investor in 2003, it took over 14 seconds for an order to – leave the retail investor, enter the marketplace, and get an execution back. Now it's just about 1.4 seconds, so an improvement of 90% over 10 years. And I think any of our customers at Fidelity would say that that's a tremendous benefit that they've received over the last 10 years. And we look at commissions in a variety of ways. Commissions are down 62% for the retail investor. So I keep referring to the retail investor. I want to take a side note and just say that, we at Fidelity are proud of the fact that we are both a large asset manager, I think, which most people know we're one of the largest mutual fund companies in the world, but we're also one of the largest online brokerage companies in the world. So we believe we bring a unique perspective to this argument that few other firms can do. We also feel that no matter what the market structure is, we can adapt our practices to deliver superior executions for both our retail investors and the institutional side of the house, which, again, is representing tens of millions of investors in our mutual fund. We do not have a proprietary trading model that's dependent upon one market structure or another. So while we are a for-profit business, as the other panelists in the second group are, we share, I think, a similar view as the SEC and the academics in that we, as Greg Berman mentioned in his opening statements, are advocates for the right structure. We're not advocating one structure or another just to support a business model. We feel we can adjust our mission to work on behalf of whatever the business the structure is. We're really out for the retail investor, and it's a voice that we feel is underheard in the marketplace. So going back to the overall market conditions, we in general feel that the marketplace by all measurements, by many measurements, not all measurements, is in a good place, both relative to where it has been, and we can certainly get into the details of that, and relative to the rest of the world. So given the terms that I opened with, what is the state of the market? We feel it is in a good spot. We also support some of the discussion that's come up recently around a holistic market review. We are very careful to advocate against any dissection of various issues in the marketplace that would potentially draw from, the overall marketplace that is today. And that, we think, is a big risk that should be not managed in one spot or another spot, but certainly collectively by the industry and the regulators. We also talked, the first panel also talked about transparency. Professor Weaver mentioned the concern and the conflicts of interest of the intermediaries. And we, of course, as a brokerage company on behalf of retail investors, are routing our order flow to market centers, to market makers, and we're going to hear from one of the market makers in the second panel. We have an obligation and a duty to find the best execution possible, and we have to weigh a variety of things. Some of those are the stability of the counterparty to whom you're sending your order. Part of it is the trust that the market center is going to execute the shares that are displayed when you send them out of order. So there's a variety of things that we look at. And we also publish on our website how much of the spread we capture and give back to our retail investors. So the average retail investor is paying $7.95 at Fidelity Online. And on average, for a 1,000-share S&P 500 stock, we're repatriating almost $4.50 of that commission in improved performance back to the retail investor. So it's something we're very proud of and something we think is, underspoken of in the industry, and we would be advocates of bringing this more to the light so that the retail investors, in fact, could have a more a transparent view of their executions. The first panel also talked about tick sizes in the context of new issuance and IPOs. And, we'll attack each issue as its own, but we do definitely see a correlation. When it comes to tick sizes and capital formation, we think one of the advantages of the tick size increment being a penny is the opportunity for spreads to be smaller. We think that benefits the retail investor. In my experience as a trader over the last 25-plus years, I can tell you, and many of the evidence supports it, that small-cap stocks were difficult to trade in 1990, they're difficult to trade in 2000, they're difficult to trade today. Now, statistically, there are variations depending on the time frame you look at, the market cap, et cetera. But clearly, I think we can all assume that statement is factually correct, that this is a difficult market to trade. We don't necessarily see the correlation of tick sizes to difficulty in trading. What we look at is market cap, the float, and the concentration of ownership. And many of our portfolio managers on the asset management side, when they're investing in a pre-IPO company, they understand that investment has no liquidity. Conversely, when they're investing in one of the mega caps that exist globally, there's tremendous liquidity given the size of the order. And, of course, the spectrum goes all the way in between. I think it's important to focus the argument on the fact that these small-cap companies present great opportunities of upside, but with that comes the encumbrances of concentration of ownership, limited float, and therefore reduced liquidity. But when it comes to capital formation, we agree that it's important that this is an issue should be looked at. And what we'd like to introduce is the fact that maybe it's something other than tick sizes. Maybe, in fact, it's actually the capital formation process itself. We've drawn some parallels back to 1995, and I think you find these facts interesting. In 1995, the average underwriting spread for an IPO in the $100 to $500 million range was 6%. Today, it's 6.6%. So you heard my earlier statistics about over the last 10 years, the improvement in equity execution, the speed, the spread condensement, the cost to trade for the retail investor. At the same time, the underwriting spread has gone up. This is at the same time we've seen an absolute revolution in e-commerce bring buyers and sellers together in a much more efficient manner. So at the lower end of the spectrum, we've begun to see crowdfunding proposals and other mechanisms to bring buyers and sellers together in a much more efficient manner. And yet the actual process for bringing companies public today in the market is not only more expensive in some cases, but it also is the exact same process where it's non-transparent allocation of orders and allocations for the night before the IPO. There's a very laborious process of taking these companies around physically into the marketplace at a time when most goods and services are sold over the web today. You know, very few goods and services, I think, that we can all point to in our personal lives are unaffected by the march of e-commerce, and certainly the IPO market is one. So we would suggest looking beyond just the empirical data and the discussion of tick sizes, et cetera, and really look at the capital formation process itself becoming more transparent and more open, and that might decrease the concentration of ownership of some of these issues. It might increase the awareness, and it might move forward. Certainly something to think about. Thank you.
Great. Well, good morning. Ari Burstein. I'm senior counsel at the Investment Company Institute here in Washington, D.C. I think I'm the only geek on my panel to do slides, but I'll whip through this given that a lot of the issues have been discussed already. But it's worth probably taking 30 seconds just to talk about who ICI is and why I'm up here, for those who may not know. So we are the National Association for the Registered Investment Company Industry. So mutual funds, ETFs, closed-end funds, UITs. The reason I say that is we don't represent hedge funds. We don't represent private equity funds, which does really play into how we look at market structure and trading, given the way our members trade. Why is that also important? Well, our members have total assets of over $16 trillion, represent 98% of all the assets of U.S. mutual funds, and maybe more importantly, we represent 96 million shareholders and over 57 million households. Again, why is that important? You heard from Brian about the retail investor, and their views on market structure. There really is a lot of debate about, when we talk about market structure, and we'll get into this in a few minutes, about protecting the retail investor, and that is a big issue at the SEC. But I think the lines have become more blurred over recent years. And again, we like to say, and we talk about this a lot in Washington, we represent the retail investor as well. And again, we don't trade proprietarily like other folks on the buy side. So that plays into our views as well. So what is our views on the market structure these days? You've heard a lot about the complexity of the markets. I think we agree with that. The markets have definitely changed very quickly over the years. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Overall, this has benefited investors. Again, every time we're based here in Washington, but every time I'm here in Washington or I'm around the globe in Brussels talking in Europe or Asia, we like to start off and say, this has benefited investors. Investors are not doing badly. The markets are not broken, as Greg Berman said earlier. I think there's some confusion about, the need to protect investors. Again, things have gone pretty well over the last few years. Costs have come down. We have more trading tools at our fingertips. Technology overall has brought good advancements for mutual funds and other investors. With that said, there are some issues that we have been concentrating on the buy side that we need to take a look at. It is difficult for the SEC. I was an SEC attorney, left about 15 years ago. It's incredibly more complex than it ever was when I was there. So, have sympathy for Greg and his colleagues, but, regulations have not really kept pace with the technological advancements. The other challenge for us is there is a general lack of understanding, I think, of how these issues impact investors, how they impact the buy side. And that's really key. So, I think it was alluded to in the first panel that the different constituencies, you'll hear from it after me, the exchanges, the brokers, a lot of folks on the sell side are in saying what is good for the investor, and then regulations come out. We end up trying to be a little bit proactive. Sometimes we're playing the reactive game, but getting in there and saying, well, that's great, but here's how it really does impact our members and trying to form the regulations that way. So what are the key issues that we're looking at on the buy side right now? Again, some of this is being a little reactive, some of it is proactive. talking a lot about, and again, these issues are not new, as you've heard already. Some of this has been around for years. All the issues around dark pools, the whole lit market versus dark market debate, what's good for investors, what's good, it's not. What I think is the most interesting discussion that we're having right now with market participants is, as you've heard, potential conflicts of interest in order routing and execution. We'll get into that in a second. The hot topic, obviously, right now is decimalization. You've heard about that already, tick sizes, and the issues that won't necessarily go away, all the issues around technology, high-frequency trading, use of algorithms, automated trading. You know, when we look at all these issues, I think it's also important to keep in mind, you've heard a lot about this already, some of the trade-offs that need to occur, and some of the things that, we've been really pushing the regulators and other policymakers to do. So need to base decisions on evidence and research. Again, that is really key. You know, I sympathize with a lot of the folks on the sell side who get frustrated around new regulations because they're not necessarily based on evidence. We've been trying to do our own research on the impact of investors and really help out the regulators. Again, I mentioned protection of what investors, retail, institutional, or both. Again, the lines are blurred. I think that's really important to keep in mind when you look at all these issues. Competition while ensuring transparent and liquid markets. Again, it's interesting from a buy-side perspective. We love competition. It's good for us. It brings down costs. But, you know, do we need 50, 60-plus trading venues in the markets these days? Probably not for our needs. So that impacts transparency. That impacts potentially how liquid the markets are. Innovation, safety and soundness. Again, protection of investors is really key. You know, glitches is the hot word these days. There are glitches probably almost every day that you hear of it. You may not hear of it. You know, the thing that is of concern to us is when I hear from our members, whether it be Fidelity or T. Rowe Price was mentioned earlier or on, that they're getting calls from their shareholders saying, are the markets safe? Are they not? You know, so again, that's something to keep in mind. Whether it's, you know, how you deal with it is another story. And then capital formation, again, tick sizes that gets to it. So just to touch base on a couple of the topics from our view, you know, obviously you've heard a lot about dark pools. Examination continues around dark liquidity. You know, I think there are a couple challenges you've already heard about. What is the impact of dark liquidity on price discovery? Is it actually harmful to investors or not? Again, you know, we sit back, but we hear, you know, whether it be the exchanges say, oh, my God, you know, we need to get everything into the lit markets or more into the lit markets. It's increasing. It's really harmful to investors. Then on the sell, on the brokerage side, well, not necessarily, you know, it's not really hurting investors. We try to, we're semi-agnostic to this. Again, you know, we need, I think, both types of trading venues, but it is a difficult discussion to have. You need to find out exactly how much percentage of trading is occurring in the dark. Again, numbers are bandied about 30%, 40%, whatever it is. I think when you start parsing through those numbers, you see that some of this is broker-dealer internalization. It's not necessarily traditional dark pools. I think that argument, especially in Washington, gets sort of blurred. And then what are the implications for funds trading? You know, realistically, we are huge users of undisplayed liquidity. We always have been. Whether before the traditional dark pools that are being talked about now, when you just had the exchanges, you had so-called reserve orders, you were hiding orders, so to speak, through floor brokers, whatever it might be. For our members, for the large asset managers, institutions, dark pools are key. With that said, you know, we do recognize all the debate, the discussion about getting orders into the lit markets. Would we love to see more orders go into the lit markets? Absolutely. But under the current market structure, and I think it was alluded to on the first panel, would any of our asset managers show a 100,000 or 200,000 share order to everybody in the world? No. What do dark pools do? They help us sort of, you know, hide that order, for lack of a better word, get that done without the market impact. So therefore, you know, again, dark liquidity is key. So what do we support here? Again, we've supported incentives for market participants to use lit markets. We've been working with other folks that you'll hear from after me and other market participants to get more orders into the lit markets. With that said, again, you've heard this before, earlier today. Yeah, we'd love to, you know, hide our orders but see what everybody else has. That's probably true, and I've probably put that into numerous comment letters I've written over the past 15 years. You know, but it's a little more nuanced than that. You know, we support exceptions for pre- and post-trade transparency. Do we want to always hard our orders forever? No. I think we've commented years back on the proposal. I guess, you know, the SEC never went forward on some more transparency in dark orders. You know, maybe for a large order that may not have that much impact, maybe you keep it non-transparent for a few hours, maybe the end of the day, maybe for a less liquid stock, maybe till the next day. But again, to reveal that, you know, in real time is probably would not work out best for us and then wouldn't work out best for our shareholders. So again, it's a little more nuanced than that. Very quickly on a couple other things, the potential conflicts of interest. Again, I think this is the most interesting discussion we're having right now. You know, we've heard, and the thing I have up on this slide is something I hear from our members. Have economics as opposed to price become the focal point in routing and execution? Have we gotten to that point in our markets? Is that good for the markets? Is that not? Maybe yes, maybe no. I think it's a little more complicated than just looking at liquidity rebates that we've heard about, the maker-taker model. There's other things that fit into this, order types that are being provided by the exchanges, access fees that are being charged out there, broker-dealer internalization. And in our discussions with market participants and trying to come up with a potential solution, again, you can't look at this in isolation. There can't be just a look at maker-taker, decide what to do there, and think it's not going to impact other things in the market. So we're thinking about how to address all these things potentially as once. You know, do you need a pilot program around that? We would probably support that. Once you start talking the details of a pilot program, it gets very difficult. Yes, there is a need to determine the impact on liquidity and price discovery. Maybe a pilot program would do that. What are the regulatory solutions? Again, maybe it is a pilot. Maybe it is transparency. Maybe if investors like our members or other investors knew more about how orders are being routed and executed, that may change behavior. That may be easier to do than spend the few years kind of taking a look at a pilot around eliminating or reducing liquidity rebates or access fees. Again, we've been meeting with market participants on this. There's other proposals out there. FINRA has a proposal to increase transparency around dark pool trading that I believe was just approved about a week ago. And also development of new trading venues. What I mean there is there's been attempts, probably not successfully, but to create new trading venues just for our members, for the buy side, for the big institutions to trade with each other, you know, to get at some of these issues that they won't charge rebates. Unfortunately, I don't think they've attracted the liquidity to make them successful. Decimalization tick sizes, you've heard about all the issues. I'll just kind of whip through this. There is legislation out there that was alluded to in the Q&A on the first panel. There is other task force reports that are out there saying that we should widen tick sizes, a letter from Citi suggesting that. There's a subcommittee of the SEC Investor Advisory Committee, which I believe is meeting actually tomorrow morning, to discuss their recommendations. Basically, everything is to create a pilot program. We support very generally a pilot program on the buy side at the ICI. Again, we're working with other market participants to try to shape the parameters around that program. We would rather have the SEC, you know, take a look and shape that pilot program than necessarily other folks outside of the regulators. You know, you can debate whether or not some of the parameters that have been bandied about are correct or not. But again, experimentation is probably good. And then last but not least, HFT technology. I'll just touch on that because, again, I think every conference I've been to, HFT is a topic du jour. excuse me. You know, again, there's no doubt technological developments have an impact on how we trade, how funds trade. HFT, we use algorithms, you know, number of types of alternative trading venues out there. You know, there's the continued focus on the disruptions. I guess from our standpoint, again, it really gets to investor confidence. We really do support regulators and policymakers looking at sort of the systemic risks that are out there, dealing with risk controls. But again, it really gets down to, in our minds, having robust risk controls in place on the sell side, whether it be exchanges or brokers. And even our members need to take some responsibility to that. just making sure there's a way to deal with, you know, any errors that occur, fat finger errors, et cetera, and the like. And again, just to end off with HFT, we have never been against high frequency trading. And let me state that again. I think HFT has kind of been beaten down, this whole argument, but there was a lot of confusion. Well, the asset managers must hate high frequency traders. We don't hate high frequency traders. There are some issues I think that we focused on too, primarily is the canceled order debate. Yes, our members have said that, you know, if someone's canceling 99% of their orders and maybe they had no intention of ever executing those orders in the first place, that's probably not a good thing. Does that tax the markets? Does that add to systemic risks to the technology disruptions? Possibly. So we need to deal with that. We've thrown out there potentially a fee or a penalty around over a certain ratio of canceled orders, as they've been looking at in other jurisdictions around the world. That's one thing. The other thing is abusive and manipulative practices. Again, I think regulators need to take a closer look at the definitions of what is abusive, what is manipulative. There's a lot of gray area out there, and that's the other thing we're concentrating on. But other than that, again, there's no definition of HST that has really been put out there. In some definitions, we are high-frequency traders as large asset managers. So I think there's, again, confusion that needs to be dealt with. That said, I'll stop there and address it in Q&A.
Do we have any football fans out there, especially this weekend? So as I was preparing for this presentation and more so the panel, I was having anxiety about being asked questions like my colleague Frank asked to one of the panelists. And I was looking forward, and of course I'm a bit of a Denver fan. I was thinking about Peyton Manning. I'm just going to yell out, Omaha, Omaha, if that occurs. And that means switch up your question for me, okay? I'm just kidding. My name's Tom Whitman, Senior Vice President at NASDAQ. Became part of NASDAQ as an acquisition of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange in 2008. And I think I probably have a bit of a unique insights on market structure as I started in 1987 at the Philadelphia Stock Exchange writing software, responsible for the software development, and watched that evolution of trading, especially in the equity markets and then the options market as we added automation. We took a floor-based options trading platform and made it completely electronic, which we saw the challenges of some institutional order flow trying to get that executed. Some would say that a trading floor, as Ari alluded to, is a quasi-dark trading pool itself. I find it interesting some of the major differences between the equity market structure and the options market structure, though. Even though they're both SEC-regulated entities, they've taken different paths. Some of the points I'd like to discuss today are trade reporting facility and dark trading, intelligent tick sizes, price improvement in equity options compared to the equity markets, and payment for order flow. I think the most obvious difference comes out of the existence of the TRF, the Trade Reporting Facility, and what that has done to the equity markets, which allows dark pools and off-exchange trading to take place, non-displayed liquidity, and then printed on the Trade Reporting Facility. I believe that that's probably a TRF is useful when it comes to dark trading for institutional order flow. I think to decrease the impact of that, those transactions where they can take place, gather liquidity and print on a TRF is makes sense. There are times when I look at this flow that I'm not sure it makes complete sense for small retail order flow, as these levels of dark trading have gotten to be 40% of the overall market. I think because this display liquidity has been impacted, because as market makers do not need to display their markets all the time on lit markets, they can provide that liquidity in dark pools to retail order flow. I think retail investors, as this happens, may not be treated equally. You see price improvement that takes place in dark trading at inside the lit market spread. So the more of that happens, it makes me believe that maybe we have unintelligent tick sizes, and we need to move more towards intelligent tick sizes, where all customers, all retail investors, can see displayed markets and execute on those displayed markets. For example, if we have price improvement taking place inside the quoted spread, maybe that quoted spread should be something different than a penny, perhaps half a penny or something inside that, tenth of pennies. The options market certainly do not have the same concept. We do have price improvement. Options that trade in pennies, quote in pennies and trade in pennies, and that represents over 85% of the volume that's traded. So it is unique. The other thing that's unique about the options price improvement mechanisms is that when these trades take place on exchange, they're subject to all the liquidity providers, and anyone can see that order flow and respond to that order flow and price improve that flow, which does not exist in dark pools. Dark pools have their own segmentation of the flow that comes in, as well as who can respond to the to that flow. That's why you don't see executions taking place at somewhere in between a penny spread on options venues. Payment for order flow is another area. You know, as I worked through my career at the Philly Stock Exchange and watched these regional specialists attract order flow and try to compete with New York, and I think one of the earlier panelists talked about this a bit, we developed a competing specialist system. Those specialist firms began to pay more and more for order flow as they attracted order flow. Yet they weren't able to, you know, we talk a lot about Reg NMS and the issues with Reg NMS, but one of the things that a protected quote brought to those people who wanted to provide liquidity to order flow was that NYSE